محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
So I'd like to first of all thank Allah for this opportunity to be here among the believers for this presentation. I also wanted to thank Brother Sean and all the others for organizing this event and giving me the opportunity to revisit this very important topic, which is that of raising children. I myself feel that I'm more in need of this topic than anybody else, because I'm a father of three, alhamdulillah, and being a father, I feel that I have certain responsibilities that I need to perform in front of God with respect to my children. And I know that there are teachings within the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, the Ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt regarding this matter. And so this was a great opportunity for me to review and revise some of these teachings. Now, before I begin, a couple of things I wanted to mention. One of them is that this is a topic which I myself am currently researching, meaning that I don't present myself as an expert on the issue. I'm researching it, I've been speaking with my teachers about it, I've been reading works of different scholars, talking to different scholars about it. And so what this presentation, what I'm aiming to do is to convey to you what I felt were some of the most important points that I've learned in this process of investigation regarding the topic of raising children from the Islamic perspective. But it's not everything, and I won't be able to answer all the questions either. I'll be giving more general principles and the big picture and some of the important points and ideas that I've gotten in this process. So that's just a disclaimer. And one of the reasons why the format of this event is as such, where only a select group of people were invited, was because of this, that I felt that I didn't want to make this something into a major public event. I wanted it to be private. And I asked that the people who come would be people who would be, inshallah, very interested in this topic, and they're coming and attending out of choice, not because it's just something that's going on and another opportunity to have some dinner or something like that. They came out of choice. I'm hoping, inshallah, there'll be good interest and good participation as well, too. As Brother mentioned, the slides, inshallah, will be provided for those who would like. And I also wanted to say thank you for the dinner. That was a good touch as well. So we did appreciate that as well, too. The agenda is basically, we want to go on for about 45 minutes, and then we'll take a break. Have some tea, inshallah, and then continue for the part two. And at the end, we'll have a question and answer and discussion, inshallah, for those who are still alive, inshallah, and still sticking around. I know that it's the end of a work week, and some of you are tired, and that's fine. If somebody needs to go or their kids are tired, they need to go to sleep, that's okay with me. I'm not going to feel bad if you have to walk out. That's fine. Alright, first of all, is this microphone necessary? Are you guys, is it helping? Like, are you hearing through the speaker? Yeah, you are? Okay. Because I can't hear anything, but okay, I'm assuming that Sean's working for you. Alright, let's go on. Yeah.
If you can come a little bit closer inside.
Okay.
I can place the chair if you want.
Okay, sure.
A bit closer.
Okay. So, right there?
No.
Yeah, okay. Alright. Okay, so next slide, please. Basically, we're going to first talk about the importance of this topic. Why discuss this? And what is the goal of upbringing? Some general tips, and then specific tips depending on the age, meaning before the child's born, childhood, preteens, youths, and then some ideas. Okay, next slide, please. Next slide. All right. So sometimes, like, this question might come up, why do we even need to talk about this? What's the point of having a seminar about it? Isn't this something which is totally intuitive? Like, we think back to when we were raised, our parents never went to, like, seminars about child raising. It was something that just happened, you know, you just kind of, like, were there and kind of were brought up and you just kind of went through it. And parents, they're busy doing whatever they're doing, like, you know, they have their business or they have their career. And they just kind of do things on an intuitive basis, like, whatever came to their mind, whatever they had inherited from their parents as to how to raise children. So, do we really need to do this? Because after all, you know, maybe we're thinking that, hey, we came out okay. Our parents did whatever they did without going through formal education regarding this topic. And we came out okay, alhamdulillah. So if you just do the same thing to our kids, then they'll come out okay as well, right? So that's kind of the question. Now, let's see if that's the case or not. Next slide, please. So first of all, whenever we think that we came out okay and that's okay, then that's kind of a step in the wrong direction. Because even if, alhamdulillah, we did receive something from our parents, we did receive what we consider to be a good upbringing, whenever we look at ourselves as a believer, we should always be looking at ourselves from the perspective of, well, what else could I be? How else could I improve? Not that I'm already there and then, you know, I'm okay and everything, as long as my kids get to where I'm at, then I've accomplished a lot. No, we should always say, look at it, I'm very thankful and grateful to whatever influence I had from my parents, my teachers, my communities, etc. But I could have been better than where I am right now. Right? So, and I'd like my children to be even better than I am. That's point number one. Point number two is that things have changed. And it's not the same as it was back then when our parents were raising us. But it's just a matter of like kind of, you know, being there for our children and being there for us and doing things. No, things have changed. Now, I want to demonstrate and bring to your attention how things have changed since that time. I'm sure these are things that you're aware of, but maybe sometimes we're aware of things, but we don't focus on them and we don't understand the importance and the gravity of them. So next slide, please. First of all, living conditions, right? These days, a lot of people are living in apartments. Now, it depends, of course, on what city you're living in. Or if we're living in homes, you know, we don't have like, big yards to play with. A lot of times people spend time indoors and kind of in claustrophobic environments as well, too. That makes a difference when it comes to raising children, because the best playground and the best play area for a child is like a backyard. And you need to have a safe environment as well, too. Back then it was safe. Today you find that there's not too much safety. The living situations as well, too. In today's world, we tend to live alone, separate from extended family, separate from other mu'mineen, other Muslims even. In fact, one of the brothers was joking. He was saying that just earlier today. He was saying that if we find that there's a neighborhood where there's like other people like us, we try to, you know, find another neighborhood. We don't want to be there, right? Because we'd rather not. You know, we don't want to be associated with that type of thing. But there was a lot of benefits in growing up with extended family around. Even today, we see that those children who, for example, live with their grandparents or the grandparents are nearby and they see them frequently, there's a marked difference in their upbringing. Because one of the reasons is they see their parents and they see how their parents have patience with their parents. And so they learn how they should have patience with their own parents. Right? And then the other thing is that when the grandparents are nearby, the grandparents become an additional way of enforcing and kind of encouraging the children to do certain things in a way that parents can't encourage them to do, because there's more respect and there's only so much you can say no to when it comes to a grandparent. And same thing with cousins and other family members as well too. It makes a difference. Living in predominantly non-Muslim environments, that's a huge point of it. And if you think that it doesn't make a difference, then we're fooling ourselves. And throughout the course of the presentation, you'll see some points as to why I'm saying that. And then the indoor lifestyle as well, too. Like, you know, in the back in the days, if the kids wanted to play, they would go to the playground. Today, you find that playgrounds are being abandoned. Like, they're not used as much as they used to be used in the past. Now it's all about Xbox, PlayStation, these types of things. And these make a huge difference in the way a child is brought up. Next slide. We also have less control over our kids. In the past, the parents and the family used to be the primary source of raising their children. But now we have competitors in that realm. There's other entities out there that are out to, number one, they're trying to undermine some of the things that we're trying to convey to our children. And number two, they have their own agenda as well. They're trying to teach children according to their own standards and what they believe in, their own beliefs and their own principles. So what are some of these competitors that we have? The secular school system. The secular school system it has an ideology behind it, has a philosophy behind it. Behind education, there's a philosophy of education. When your philosophy is something which inherently is absent of God, doesn't have God in mind at all, Do we imagine that it's not going to have an impact on the way that the children are taught? Definitely it's going to have an impact. Right? The ideals that are taught, the morals that are taught, when God isn't in the picture, it's going to have a huge impact on the way the child thinks. Now, you might say that, no, my child is going to a secular school, so we all went to that, many of us went to that, myself included, right? I went to public school, right? And we're saying our prayers, we're doing everything, we're doing our wajibat, right? I'm not talking about wajibat here. I'm talking about the way that we view the world, the principles by which we adhere to, the morals that we stand for, right? These are the things that get hammered in by the system that you're part of. The teachers that we have, a similar sort of point. I mean, my son, who's now 7 years old, already, like, he listens to his teachers more than he listens to me. Right? Alhamdulillah, his teachers happen to be, like, Muslim, Shias, practicing people who teach them good things, right? But, I mean, that's when it comes to me. I don't know, maybe you have a similar experience, right? That the children consider the teachers to be God almost, right? And so if your teachers are somebody who doesn't believe in God, then what kind of God is that? What are they listening to? Friends, similar sort of input. Daycares, media, technology. Like, sometimes when it comes to technology, we tend to have this sort of misperception. Like, we think of companies like Google. Usually people think of Google as being like a friendly sort of entity. Like, it's our friend. Google's our friend. Right? They make good things for us, right? They make good technology for us. They help us do things better and easier, right? Okay, fine. Okay, that's all there. But is Google really your friend? I mean, Google's out to make money from you at the end of the day, right? Like, they're driving force, the driving force behind what they do is to make money. They're a company. They have shareholders. They have to report to them. So when the goal is making money, then there's going to be some point where they choose that over, you know, ethics and God, right? And that happens, right? But with such a pervasive, media being so pervasive, it's unbelievable. I mean, you'll have in one house, you'll have, for example, the father saying his prayers, the mother saying his prayers. The children are like on their phones and doing God knows what at prayer time, right? You don't really know what happens and what sort of things take place. And, you know, our children are much more savvy than we are when it comes to technology and what goes on there. Some of these things have become so part of even our private lives that we wake and sleep to them. I mean, some people, like, they go to sleep after watching their favorite TV show at night. They go to sleep after, like, consulting their phone and looking at their Facebook or looking at Twitter or something like that. They wake up and the first thing they do before they even, you know, make their way to the restroom, in the washroom, to, like, wash up and do wudu and say thank you to Allah for giving them the opportunity to once again be alive, they go to their phone and they start checking what's going on, right? And it becomes a habit. I mean, like, if somebody were to lose their phone, it's like, you know, the world's gonna, like, end or something. That's how much part of our lives these things have become. And that means that they're going to influence the way our children are raised as well. And as I mentioned here, that they have their own goals in mind for how to raise our children, which many times are in opposition to what we would like our children to be and what we want them to stand for. Next slide, please. Some other things have changed as well, too. Corruptive elements are much more widely available than they were in the past. Let me just give you one example of pornography. Even when I was growing up, pornography was something that took some effort to come by. It wasn't something that was readily available. It took a cost. It took a price. It took, like, you know, a certain procedure to be able to come by it. Whereas today, it's something that is freely available and can be done at, you know, at the convenience of one's home, right? So when that becomes the case, then that becomes something that we have to be much more aware of as parents with respect to our kids being exposed to that type of thing. Also, there's in the society that we live in, there's a craze to make it big and live it big as well, too. And this is something that Muslims are not immune from. If you go and look at the lifestyles that many of us have adopted and the decisions that we make in our lives, oftentimes it goes back to this type of philosophy. This is really like what we stand for. And this is the goal that we're aiming for. Maybe not us Muslims, maybe the people around us. Fine. But that still has an impact on us as well, too. As a result of that, what happens? You have people working long work hours, you know, putting in some overtime, trying to, like, you know, like, go beyond even what's needed to live comfortably. Why? Because there's this craze, this hunger for what? For getting into a bigger house, for what? For, you know, making more incomes, for what? So we can go on vacation more, so we can do what? But it's just, at the end of the day, it's like this cycle, right? That you earn more so you can consume more, so that you can earn more, that you can consume more, and then eventually you die. And that's it. So another thing is that lack of contentment when home. Somebody who has this type of philosophy, when they come home, they're going to be tired, first of all, from working so much, and then they're not going to be happy. There's that sense of like, in the past, people would be satisfied, a lot more satisfied with their lives. Today you find depression, you find unhappiness, discontentment. And then you have mothers taking on jobs as well too. I'm not saying that mothers shouldn't take on jobs, or that mothers, if some a mother does that, she's doing something wrong. You know, sometimes it's necessary. But sometimes it's not necessary, and the children are suffering as a result. And what happens then is that we're not able to raise our children the way we were in the past. Next slide, please. Some other things as well too. Like one of them is this idea of Frankenfood. You know, like in the past, like food used to be wholesome, and you know, like food used to be food. But today, we're not sure what really food is about sometimes. You know, the type of stuff that we feed our kids, the effects that it has on them. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of if you've studied these type of things, if you're aware of like the links, the linkage they come up with, like the modern sort of food additives and like the effects it has on the child's health. Like they say diseases like attention deficit disorder, like some part of that, I'm not saying all of it, but some part of that is directly linked to food allergies. Like in particular, like the red food coloring that they put in food, that has a particularly bad impact on some kids. It makes them have ADD, all right, or other types of diseases as well too. Now, a lot of that has to do like Lunchables, right? You just go and look and look at the history of how they had to convince people that it's okay to eat meat that's like 2-3 months old. Like what they had to go through in order to like market that to people, because before they would never accept that idea that we would ever want to do such a thing. That has an impact on children, okay? Because when our children are eating food like that, then they start behaving in different ways as well too. And sometimes we're trying to discipline them, and we don't realize that, wait a minute, this is coming back to them not feeding them wholesome food. Environmental pollution. An example would be like high estrogen levels in cow's milk. Like you find, sometimes you find children, when they come to a certain age, they're confused about their orientation when it comes to their sexual orientation. Now, why is that, right? Is it what happened? What changed? Why is it in this society and not other societies? Some of it has to do with like being tainted with like, you know, sort of education and kind of a mindset thinking that okay, that you know, there's no such thing as like, you know, a man has to be oriented in a certain way and a woman has to be oriented in a certain way. But some of it has to do with the food that we eat. For example, estrogen. Estrogen is a female hormone. That has a way of getting into like the water supply. That has a way of getting into like milk as well too. And when male children, for example, drink that, or even female children, and they have an excess level of this hormone, it's going to cause, obviously it's going to cause, it has an impact on the way they are. And so that's become something we have to be aware of, and we have to make sure that we're feeding our children healthy food. Another thing is parents having less children, not having friends in the family, having to like look outside, or having to entertain with like technology rather than peers in the form of siblings. Next slide, please. So given, there's just a bit of it. Like I haven't gone into like the details, right? I mean, I could have expanded about the food thing and talked about different things. I could have expanded about the friends thing. But I just kind of gave a bit, just to kind of, you know, awaken the sentiments. I think that brothers and sisters, you're all aware of these points to some extent. But the point is that can we just say we're too busy for studying the subject and just let things turn out however they do? No, we can't. It's something which is very important. Tonight we've gathered here, it's just a one-time sort of seminar, but really this is something that a class needs to be you know, taught and prepared and taught on the subject. And because there's a lot of different areas where, alhamdulillah, we have rich teachings from the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, but these are not being, they're not accessible, and they're not being talked about, and they're not being requested, but they need to be. And this is one step in that direction. I just want to give a quote here from Ustad Abbasi. Abbasi is one of the contemporary scholars in Iran. He's one of the leading figures in this area of tarbiyat, and of raising children, and even family issues as well too. He's an author, and he's a well-respected scholar of the Hawza. He says that there's no way, he's the Behish Waj in Farsi, there's no way that one can raise a child to realize the goals that the religion of Islam has set forth for a child by employing secular child-raising techniques. So what I mean by that is that if we think that, okay, if we just raise our kids like everyone else around us is raising them, and just kind of, you know, have a little bit of emphasis on Islam, meaning that, you know, just take them to Sunday school, you know, but kind of do everything the same. Inside of our house, there's not too much difference between what happens inside of our home and what happens inside of, let's say, our non-Muslim neighbor's home. And we freely, you know, interact and mingle, and there's really not that much of a difference except for during prayer times and the food that we eat and some of the rituals, right? Then there's no way, in his words, that we're going to be able to raise our children in the way that God intended for them to be raised. What that means is that we need to understand at a deep level what are the goals that the religion of Islam has for when it comes to raising our children, and what are the techniques that it's given us as well too. And those techniques, as we see, will fundamentally differ from what we see out there. So if we ever see ourselves raising our children just like a typical non-Muslim raises their children, but with a bit of a difference when it comes to, like, let's say, prayer time and stuff like that, then we know that we're not going in the right direction. There has to be a fundamental difference. Next slide, please. Alright, so this topic here is a few slides about what is the purpose of it, what is the goal, what are we trying to do here as parents, like what is it that God wants us to do? And this is important for us to step back and look at it analytically. I realize that it's a bit kind of philosophical, right? But sometimes you have to look at things philosophically and understand the bigger picture before you can talk about practical techniques. And part of this, we will be talking about practicalities. Right now it's a little bit philosophical and theoretical. Okay, first of all, what is the purpose of life? The purpose of life, there is a purpose, number one, and the purpose is, according to this verse of the Quran, it's Allah said that I did not create the jinn and the humans except that they may worship me. There's a goal. The goal is that we need to attain and reach the level where we are servants of Allah. Us, we, and our children as well too. That's the goal. Okay, next slide, please. When I, as a parent, I'm looking at my child, I'm looking at what should my goal be. First of all, I should have a goal. And my goal isn't just to, like, get my child, you know, married and happily living and, you know, for example, have a comfortable life. No, that's good. We should want that from our children, right? But there should be something else that we're striving for, something even bigger and better and higher and greater. What is that? That we should be wanting our children to become a perfect servant of Allah. Okay, in other words, we want them to become a perfect human being. In other words, we want them to become a perfect follower of the Imam of the time. Now, you might say that, okay, Brother Salim, that's fine, but isn't that too high? Isn't that something which is like, you know, really like, you're talking about like Ayatollah level or like Ayatollah Behjad level or something like that, you know, like, that's not for us, that's not for our kids, right? The answer is no. Like, what right do I have as a parent to come in and be the barrier between the plan of God, the plan that God has for my child? Right? Because God creates this child and He has a plan for him or her. He wants this child to be His perfect servant. He wants him to grow up and be and reach Him and to come to Him. Right? Now, why should I come in as a parent and say that, no, I just want my child to be just somebody who's going to average the average type of thing, or even a good Muslim. No, we want them to become, always be striving and aspire for the greatest, right? If our child, him or herself, says that, no, I don't want that, that's different. But as a parent, I should be setting my goals like the highest possible. Okay, next slide, please. So, in summary, right, the goal is what? So Allah created us with a purpose, number one. Number two, He created us with the potential to arrive at that purpose. He wants that of our children. He puts that potential in them as well too. Okay, our children, even if we might think that they're like the most, like, you know, sort of, I don't know, like mischievous kids or whatever, right? They have the potential to become a perfect human being. They have the potential to become right up there as among the group called Awliya of Allah. Right? And the Quran talks about this group as the Mukhlaseen, the special elite chosen people. Allah created them and they're wired with that potential in them. So our goal as parents is to unlock that potential, to unleash that potential. Right? That's our goal. So this is kind of captured in this dua of Imam al-Islam. It's very beautiful. He says, Ilahi, Anta kama uhib, faj'alni kama tuhib. right? These two lines here, you can, inshallah, memorize these. It's good for you to, like, to once in a while say these in your du'as as well too. Then we say, oh Allah, anta kama uhib. You are the way that I love. Faj'alni kama tuhib. So make me the way that you love as well. And in this we find, like, the goal of life captured in this one simple du'a, which is that the most beloved entity that we know about is Allah, and we want Him to give us that tawfiq and that ability to become like one who is beloved by Him. Which means that we want to become perfect, we want to be the best that we can possibly be. Okay, next slide please. So, what I'm doing then as a parent is I have to guide my child to achieve their potential. I want to remove the impediments. Like, imagine that, like, okay, the analogy here is like somebody, like a gardener. Like, you plant, let's say you plant a flowering tree, a sapling in your garden. Okay, now that tree right there is going to grow because the sun is there, the rain is there. It's going to grow. But once in a while, you might see that there's weeds that come up. You have to go and remove those weeds, right? You have to remove any obstacles that prevent it from growing. But are you, as the gardener, are you responsible for actually making it grow? No. It's growing, right? It's the sun, the moon, the nature of the system that God has created is that tree is going to grow. Right? You don't have to worry about the growing. What you have to worry about is just making sure that you're facilitating this act to actually take place. There's an important difference here, right? Is that, see, as a parent, I shouldn't think that everything is on my shoulders. It's not. Right? I don't have to do everything, except the gardener. Everything's not on the gardener's shoulders. No, the gardener just needs to go and make sure that there's no impediments there, make sure that he's doing his part of it. But there's a whole process in place here. There's a whole plan that God already has for your child. All we need to do is play our little role when it comes to that process right now. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so now, what are some general principles when it comes to upraising and upbringing a child? And then we'll talk about specific age groups after that. These apply to any age, whatever our child is at. Okay. Well, the first one is that the principle of starting with the self. If we want to guide our children, the only way we can guide them is if we ourselves are guided. If we want our children to be individuals who are striving to move towards Allah, we ourselves have to be striving to go towards Allah. And I can't repeat this enough, right? Because this is the most effective, the most important way of raising good children. Okay, look at what the Quran says. The Quran says that, Ya أيها الذين آمن قو أنفسكم وأهليكم نارا. O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire whose fuel is people and stocks. Look at the order here. First, you have to save yourselves, and then you can save your families. Another verse: will you bid others to piety and forget yourselves? Right? Can we really think that we're going to be effective in any way in teaching our children something when we ourselves have forgotten about our own selves? Right? The same way that God has a plan for our children, He has a plan for you and me as well too. Right? Many parents, by the time they become parents, they forgot about this. They forgot that, wait a minute, they too are supposed to be striving towards God. They too weren't supposed to halt somewhere. They too need to be working on themselves and making progress towards Allah as well. Look at Imam Ali Islam. He says that, مَن نَصَبَ نَفْسَهُ إِمَامًا لِغَيْرِهِ Whoever appoints himself as a leader for others, فَلْيَبْدَ بِتَعَلِيمِ نَفْسِهِ قَبْلَ تَعَلِيمِ غَيْرِهِ He had to begin with teaching himself before teaching others. Right? We as parents, we're teachers, right? We're guides. So this applies to us. And let he train others with his own behavior before training them with his own tongue. Meaning that in terms of importance, in terms of effectiveness, what's going to be my most effective means of conveying something to my children? It's going to be through my own behavior. That's number one. Second thing is going to be what I tell them and what I would direct them to do. But the first and foremost is my own behavior. Next slide, please. So, examples. Okay, these are important examples, right? They fit into one slide, but each one of them could be talked about in its own discussion. So, the way that we treat our parents, for example, the way that my son and my daughters see me interacting with my own parents, that's going to obviously rub off on the way that they interact with me. Okay, it's a direct sort of way for them to learn how to treat parents. How we treat our spouses. When he sees me, for example, looking kindly at my wife, when he sees me overlooking her mistakes, when he sees me talking to her well, then you know, my children are is going to rub off on them as well too. Right? They're going to understand, okay, this is the way that we have to treat this woman who's in the home. And vice versa. When they see, when the children see that the husband is somebody who's respected, that somebody, the husband is somebody who's admired, that somebody, the husband is somebody who is cared for, right, who's considered as the leader in the family, they themselves are going to follow suit as well too. How we interact with, how we talk about others, right, in the home. If in the home we see that, that the children see that other people are the topic of our conversation, in negative sort of ways, then that's obviously going to like interact and rub off on them. But if they see that at home it's taboo to talk about other people, other people's private lives, right, then obviously they're going to follow suit as well too. Of course, there's some exception, right? That sometimes, like when, especially when our children reach a certain age, we need to start educating them about and let them know that not everyone is innocent. Not everyone is like, we can't be naive about this. We have to start pointing out that there is haqq, there is batil, and that there are leaders and representatives of batil as well too. And we have to start educating them about, that, about this. And they might be surprised about this as well too. But what I'm talking about here is like people's private lives, people's meaning, right? They shouldn't be the topic of conversation at home. How we interact with non-mahrams as well too. When our children see that our father and mother they act differently with the opposite gender than they do with their own gender, that's going to have an impact on the way they do it as well too. So many times, like the way the children behave in this respect is purely derived from how they see their parents do it. How we consume technology as well too. Right? If we only understood like the harms that technology has on a child's upbringing, right? Sometimes we think that technology is there to help our children, right? So it can in limited form, but oftentimes it's used as a crutch. Instead of trying to parent our children, we say, okay, go watch TV, go use this device, right? Here's your iPad, play this game, that type of thing, right? We use it as an excuse instead of spending time with our children, right? Instead of talking to them, instead of trying to show them how to play and be creative and use their imagination. If we ourselves are consumed by technology, if we don't have control, we're not using it on a rational basis, they too will follow suit in that respect. And then of course, how we practice our faith as well too. Now, when it comes to our behavior, what they tell us is that the negative behavior that a parent displays, that's going to have more of an impact on a child than the positive behavior. Let me give you an example. If you ever see like a scene in a very frightening movie, let's say like a horror movie, okay, like one scene from a horror movie, if it's very scary, that can be something that stays with you for a lifetime, right? It's always there, and you know, like maybe even for like a week afterwards, you're scared by it, right? It's something which is negative. Right? Whereas if you see like happy scenes, you know, people like you know, or funny scenes, that type of thing, it just kind of you know, you see it. It doesn't have such an impact on you. When it comes to behavior that parents display, if the children see even one negative thing, one backbiting, one display of anger that was unnecessary, one interaction with a non-mahram that was inappropriate, one lack of courage when it comes to displaying the deen of Islam, even one of these, it will stick with them for a long time to come. Okay, so we have to be very careful when it comes to this. On the other hand, when it comes to positive behavior, like talking well, speaking well, looking well at one another in the family, showing love, these type of things, this has to be done again and again in order to have it actually hit home for the children. So, what's an example? Another example. What's the first thing that's discussed when, for example, the working father enters the home and sees the family? Let's say that it's been a long day. Okay, the father went out. Now he's coming back home again. Right, he walks in the door. Right? What's the first topic of conversation that's going to happen? Right? Is he going to be like acting all tired and like you know, demanding things and asking, "Okay, what's for dinner tonight?" Right? If that's what he's talking about, like let's say the topic's about food and how tired he is, then children will eventually learn what? That the most important thing in life is our comfort and what food we're going to have. Right? Now, I'm not saying I enjoy comfort, I enjoy food as well too. Those are good things, right? But there's more to life than this, right? Whereas if the father comes home and the first thing he does is, you know, he smiles, and he puts aside his tiredness, right? At least temporarily. He smiles, he like hugs the children, he just, you know, shows love to them. He asks how everyone's day was, right? He asks what's going on. Then the children will start to learn that, hey, there's something more important than just these, you know, things like food and these things. Like food, you know, food is, you know, comes and goes, and you know, inshallah it's there. And if it, you know, inshallah, I mean, it's taken care of. And if not, then we can make arrangements for it, right? It's not like the end of the world, right? Another thing, like, how does one's spouse react to being wronged by the other? You can just run through kind of history, recent history, and just think, when's the last time that one of the, either the husband or the wife, did something wrong to the other? Maybe they made a comment which was unnecessary, they shouted at them, they screamed, whatever it is, okay? What was the reaction of the other party? Was it that, like an equal and opposite reaction, or even a greater reaction, that like, you know, if you're going to come to me with that, then I have my own sort of like, you know, sort of arrow that I can fire as well too, right? Or was it one of like, of responding with love and tolerance and respect? Okay, it's a simple question to ask, right? That type of thing rubs off on our children as well too, because like we're trying to raise children who are halim, right? Halim, hilm is that ability to like bear with other people's shortcomings, right? Like, when we see other people, like, we don't respond that way. No, we hold ourselves to a higher standard. Next slide, please. So what are some acts that are particularly influential in, like, because we're talking about like how that we need to start with ourselves, right? What are some things that are particularly influential? So one of them is the observation of Allah's prohibition and obligation. It's obvious, right? That when the children see the parents strictly adhering to wajibat and muharramat in all aspects of their lives, when it comes to income, when it comes to halal income, when it comes to food, when it comes to dress, when it comes to things that we say, things that we see, things that we consume in terms of media that we consume, etc., etc., that's going to have a huge impact on the children. When the children see that their parents have a program of ibadah, this is very important as well too. They don't just see their parents like grudgingly offer their wajibat. No. They see that their parents they lead a normal life. They have like their work, they have their social, they have whatever. But the thing that they're really excited about is their program of ibadah. That once in the day, they have a certain amount of time they set aside when they do what they need to do on their prayer mat and they're talking to God and they enjoy that. And they look forward to that. In fact, that's like everything else is secondary to that, right? When they see that, and that's part of their lives, then it's going to automatically rub off on them. Hey, wait a minute, so that's the goal of life. That's what we're here for. We're here for worshipping Allah, for growing, for developing and increasing our relationship with Allah. Especially if they can see their parents like rising early in the morning and they hear their voices whispering and reciting the Quran and the du'as of the Ahlul Bayt, then realize, hey, wait a minute, all this stuff that we hear about the imams and stuff like that, I see some of that in my parents as well too. Like, that's the way I want to be as well. This is very important, brothers and sisters. Maybe this can be an impetus for us to get serious about working on ourselves and having our own program with God. Reciting prayers on time as well too. Now, this whole topic of how do I get my child to pray, that itself requires like, you know, 2-3 classes. Just there's so much advice that we have from the Ahlul Bayt on this one topic. It's a really important, necessary topic. But one of the best ways is if we make prayer time an event at home. It's actually an event, right, where everyone's kind of participating in together. We have a common area that we're praying in. We make it something fun as well too, right? We're like, oh, it's time, we're looking forward to it, right? We're smiling, we're making it fun. Not something which is like a strict chore type of thing. Like one of the authors, he mentioned this, let's say you're playing with your kid, right, and Adhan comes, right? Now one thing you could do is like say, oh, prayer time, okay, we have to put this away, you know? Or you could say in a very gentle way, you could say that, okay, prayer time's come, will you allow me to like go say my prayers right now, and then we'll come back and we'll finish off playing, okay? Simple things like that, the way that we treat the prayers. Like for example, with my daughter, right, one of the things that we noticed is that she really has this inclination to pray, but she also likes stories as well too. we told her that, okay, like once in a while, after the prayers, you know, we'll tell you a story as well too. She's looking for the prayers and she's looking to the story as well too. For some of the, like the girls, right, they like to have like their nice, like, you know, chadars for namaz and like their nice, like, sort of prayer mats. Even the boys as well too. You know, like have a nice, like, beautiful sort of thing where they can pray on their special, you know, like, such that God, their special, like, mohr, as we say, a nice tasbih as well too. You know, whatever it is that will make them feel like this is something special. And then everyone joins in as well too. The father joins in, the mother joins in. If the mother happens not to be praying at this time, it's that's the time of the month for her. That's okay. She can sit there and do dhikr. She can do dhikr of Allah. That's very highly recommended that during the time of prayer that she does that. She faces Qibla and does dhikr of Allah. Children are there as well too. Maybe initially they're just playing around. They're just like playing toys, whatever. They're walking around. But that's okay. Because as they get older, then they'll realize that, hey, this is what we do when this time comes in, and naturally they'll kind of join in the process as well too. Without even us taking too much pains to invite them, they will join in and they'll join us as well in that. Sometimes, of course, we could take them to the masjid as well too, if there's a masjid nearby. Sometimes we do it at home, especially when there's no masjid nearby. Next slide, please. What are some other acts that are particularly influential? Respect to one another, having patience and tolerance. I talked about that. Speaking sweetly to one another. There should be no reason for why at home there should be shouting. Right? Shouting should not... In a household of a mu'min, like, there's no room for shouting. Yes, occasionally, at times, rarely, it might be the case that a parent will need to raise his or her voice, occasionally, right? In order to convey a point to their child. But even when they're raising their voice, it's a controlled raising of the voice. It's out of intellect, not out of emotion. There's a big difference. They're fully in control of their emotions at that time. Whereas sometimes you find the opposite is true, that normally the decibel level at home, it's like, tends to be like really high, right? And it's like rare when, like, you know, voices are just kept like kind of calm, right? But in a believer's home, there's no need for them to be shouting within space. And then don't speak negatively about others. We talked about that as well too. Let me next slide, please. Principle number two is that love and respect are at the core of Islamic upbringing. These are two principles. Then look at this hadith. The Prophet says, love your children and be kind to them. Love your children and be kind to them. Imam Sadiq, indeed Allah loves His servant on account of the intensity of love that he or she has for his child. You've seen these traditions before, probably. But when you look at them we're trying to look at advice that the Ahlul Bayt have for us when it comes to raising our children. What this tells us is one of the key ways for us to be able to raise our children in the right way is to have a relationship of love with them. I want to pause here because this is something that you can take as being like just obvious, right? Or it can be something for us to actually think about and apply. Let me give you an example. Normally when we have an infant, right, we want to show them a lot of love. Right, you kiss your infant, you like play with them, you're always talking to them, you're hugging them. You always want to, even if it's not even your infant, let's say it's like a family member, or even somebody who just kind of, you see a baby somewhere. There's something within us where we want to go and want to display love to them. Right? Yeah? Okay. Now, what happens usually is that as the child grows older, and especially if they have another sibling, that wantingness, that wanting, feeling of wanting within us to display love to the child tends to diminish. Okay? We stop doing it. And it gets to the point where usually, like, we rarely will do that. We rarely will show actively, try to demonstrate. Yeah, well, once in a while we'll say, like, I love you, or give them a hug or something, but it's not something that defines our relationship with our child. What the Ahlul Bayt tell us is that even if our child is not an infant anymore, but one of the strongest ways that we as parents can connect to our child is by displaying love to them. Whether it be the way that we talk to them, the way that we look at them, the way that the body language that we have with them, the way that we teach them things, the way that we discipline them as well. So all of these have to be on the basis of love. Not only love, but also respect as well too. These are two key principles. And both of these, again, could be talked about a lot. I just want to mention that at this point, that these are very, very important. Look at this. Like, Nabi Musa asks Allah, he says, what is the act which is most pleasing to you? And this is Hadith al-Qudsi. He replies, love of children. He doesn't say Salat. He doesn't say Zakat. He doesn't say Hajj. He doesn't say, you name it. He says, love of children, for they have been created upon my Tawheed. And next slide, please. Now, why is it that sometimes love doesn't lead to results? Let's say that, okay, I'm trying to show love for my child. Why is it that sometimes it doesn't lead to results? One of them is because we don't use different techniques for displaying love. Sometimes we think that, okay, in order to be a loving father, a loving mother, I just need to tell my children I love you. I just need to kiss them. It's not just that. Okay, as I said, even the way we discipline them, even the way that we play with them, everything has to be on the basis of love. And there's detailed instructions. Again, we can't go through everything, but I just want to mention that one of the things we can do is look and see, are we really using every technique possible to show and demonstrate love to our child? Another one is not showing respect along with that love. Children need respect just as they need love. And as a child, as a parent, I need to make sure that I respect my child. I don't always eat away at them, especially the father figure. The father needs to make sure that he doesn't always... He respects, gives his children their own room and respects who they are and what they stand for and even what they think about as well too. Another type of thing is sometimes we display love for accomplishing our own purposes. So what I mean by that is that, for example, we'll want something from our child, and when we want something, we'll show love to them. But other times we won't show love to them. Let's say, like, you know, I want my child to, like, you know, I have a 1-year-old child or a 6-month-old child, right? And they're doing some sort of, like, mischievous thing, right? So I go to them, I kiss them, I show them love so I can, like, kind of take something away from them. Right? Next time they go and do something, again, once I go and I kiss them, I take away something from them. And they're going to pick up on that. Like, okay, my father and mother showed me love. It's kind of a way of bribing me and you know, kind of taking me away from something I want to do. Then they understand that it's not true love in all circumstances. Another one is that sometimes we want to... see results, but we don't see that because we're drowned out by love shown by other competitors. Because the way that that, like, the media gets to our children is that they win over their hearts. Right? How do they win over their hearts? By using figures that will capture the love of our children. You guys know what I'm talking about here? Like, for example, what?
Dora the Explorer.
Yeah, exactly. Like Dora the Explorer, right? Or, like, you know, when they get older, like different, like, celebrities, like music stars and movie stars and, I don't know, Academy, whatever, you know, those things, right? Those people, stars, right? What is a star? A star is something that attracts the attention of others, right? They become the beloved of our children, right? So it's just a reminder about the influence of media and mitigating that as well, too. Right, next slide, please. Okay, we're almost done with this this part right here. Then we're going to take a break, inshallah, and then we'll continue. Another point, I think there's only 4 principles I talk about, maybe 5, but 4, but Islamic upbringing is holistic. Sometimes we hear a few things in some majlis or something, we apply that and we don't see results. And the important thing is to note is that Islamic upbringing is holistic. So, let me give you a couple of examples. Sometimes, like, we're told in hadith, right, that one of the ways of disciplining is to temporarily freeze relationships, meaning temporarily we stop talking to our child. Okay, but is that something that we're supposed to use frequently, you know, as a means of discipline? No. It's supposed to be used selectively and only along with other things. So, for example, like, if I do that and I already have a bad relationship with my child, I stop talking to my child will be really happy, right? They're like, oh, my father stopped telling me, like, you know, things to do, now I'm free, right? I'll be free from him, like, nagging on me, right? On the other hand, if I'm a parent that I've always shown love, I've always been, like, supporting my child, and then, like, for, let's say, an hour or two, I tell them, look, you've done something and I don't feel like talking to you for that thing that you've done, they'll feel so bad of not having that conversation open, that line of conversation open with me, then it'll have a huge impact on them. But you see how it has to come alongside with that love, right? Or another thing that maybe you've heard about is that you've seen that in hadith we're told that when a child reaches 9 years old and they don't say their prayers, then you should punish them, right? And sometimes we're told that we should hit them, right? And that has its own discussion about what does that hadith say? Does it say that we should hit them? Is that the only way of disciplining? Is that supposed to be done in a certain circumstance? That's its own discussion. But the point is that this is the case for somebody who, if a parent has been working with their child and they've been like, from an early age, like they've set up the environment of prayer, right? From age 7, they've started asking their children with love and coaxing them to start praying and urging them to do so. And they're working on them 7, 8, but in fact, even without working on them, if they have the environment, by 7 years old, many times the child will start praying, they'll want to start praying. By 8, if not 7, then 8. By 9, it's rare that a child will not be saying their prayers. And in that case, it's a punishment, but that punishment is more of a means of waking them up to reality. Kind of like you sometimes you like kind of shake somebody, say, are you awake? You know, like just smell the coffee. Like, you know, like here's a bit of fresh air for you, right? That's what it's meant to be. Not that you've never had any effort. Now at age 9, you look and say, you know, you're getting old now. For a girl, she's reached of age. You better be seeing your parents. If you don't, I'm gonna spank you, right? That's not what the hadith means, right? So these need to be talked about in the holistic sort of sense. Okay, next slide. Another principle is presenting a united front. This is obvious, right? That there will be different disagreements between the mother and father when it comes to techniques, right? When that happens, the children should not be aware of this. The children should always see their parents as being united in their disciplinary, in their upbringing, their strategy. And if there's any disagreements, they should be taken offline and in private discussion between the father and the mother. And also, the father should be presented as the major decision maker and the leader of the family. Even though it might be the case that it's the mother's idea of how to deal with a particular situation, but it should be that the father is being presented. That's important as well, too, that the parents apply this. Okay, next slide. Okay, so from now on, the presentation is about tips for before a child is born, and then when they're at the child age, the youth age, no, the child age, the preteen age, and then the teenager age. And at the end, I have some ideas that I've gotten just through my own experiences visiting different cities or towns. Yeah.
Like you're talking about, continuing on the point of the brother made, Disney and all these are like, they're so much emphasized and there's so much around,
right,
that it's very difficult to control, as you said,
yeah.
Right? But even if you're doing some controlled kind of environment, providing controlled kind of environment, we have to provide alternatives, right?
Awesome, yes.
So, I mean, if you do not have alternatives to that, then kid has nothing to do, right?
Yeah.
Like, he has to be occupied by something. He has to look forward to some role model, right?
Yeah.
So the amount of money and the effort that Disney puts in,
yeah,
we don't have any alternative right now,
right,
in Islamic perspective,
right,
to provide to the kid.
Right.
So it makes it very difficult,
okay,
like as you mentioned,
sure,
right? Like,
sure.
So how do you provide an alternative that is attractive enough,
right,
and it is under the Islamic perspective to,
right,
be to provide to your children?
Okay, so question, just to summarize, is what's the alternative? How do we provide an alternative that's attractive? Okay, because the amount of money that is being put into Disney and the efforts and the results as well, they don't compare when it comes to what we have.
Exactly.
So one way of looking at it is to say, okay, well, what do we have? What's been come up with as an alternative? Like, so, for example, there's something called Adam's World. I don't know if you guys are aware of Adam's World. Yes? Yes or no?
Yes.
You've seen it? Yeah. Sisters? Adam's World?
DVDs.
Okay, there's a set of DVDs by Sound Vision, right? It's like a company that produces media for children, or for all adult children and adults. Like, it's from the Ahlul Sunnah. But generally speaking, their themes are in this Adam's World show. It's for kids. It's like a puppet. It's like a Sesame Street type of thing for kids. Generally speaking, the themes are good. And you know, my kids, for example, they really like that. You know, they like watching and stuff. So that's one thing. There's also some books as well too that are out there that you know, kids will like. If I can think about that a little bit more and give you some ideas. Some movies as well too. There's some Islamic movies that we need to like get our kids into. Like, there's a cartoon series where they go through the lives of like 8 to 10 prophets. And they use computerized cartoon graphics for that. I haven't seen it yet on Shia TV. I don't think it's there yet. Or maybe it's there, but it's not there with the subtitles yet. but it's really well done. And like, if you watch it from the beginning, it goes through the story of, all the way till the story of Nabi Dawood and Nabi Sulaiman, and like the Talut and Jalut and that whole battle, and like, it's really well done. And the themes that they portray, like the sub-themes, like, excellent. And it's all cartoon as well, too. There's a whole series about Ashabi Kaf, like the people of the cave. Really well done. My son was glued to that. He really enjoyed that.
It's animated.
No, that one's not animated.
What's the name of this series?
The Nabi Sulaiman one?
No, this whole Prophet series.
Oh, that one? Yeah, it's... in Farsi, it's Farman... Farman, Farman, but that's the holy leaders or something.
It's translated in English?
I'm not sure about if it's translated into English.
No, I've seen that in either Persian or Arabic, but not in English.
It hasn't been done in English, okay. So that's something that like, it doesn't require that much effort. If there were like a group that wanted to, like, you know, put some of these things, put subtitles on them. That one in particular, I really liked the whole way they did it. And if you watch from the beginning until the end, you see the same themes being kind of conveyed. Whereas if you just start in the middle of it, then you kind of think that, oh, what's this about? Like, you don't really understand what's going on at the time of Nabi Sulaiman. But it actually depends on something that happened way before. And the kids were glued to that when they're watching that. So that's one way of approaching it. There's other resources as well. We could talk about that, come up with a list of it. Another way is to say that, well, wait a minute, why is there so much of a dependency on these types of things and our kids having to spend time with them? Like, can we raise our children where they are less dependent on shows and media, right? Where there's other things they look to for fun, but there's other ways that they occupy their time with. But that's what we need to look at. Like, we should regularly be taking our children out to the playgrounds, to like the parks, to the to the lakes, like to the rivers, to like camping, these type of things, right? Spending time with them, sports as well too. To a certain extent, right? Where it doesn't trample on the guidelines of Islam, especially when it comes to hijab and these type of things. Basically, coming up with like viable alternatives where this not such a dependency on like characters and toys, these type of toys. Even in toys, right? There's whole lines of toys. For example, Melissa and Doug. Melissa and Doug has a line of toys, mostly for kids like maybe from the ages of like say 2 to like 10, like that age range, where it's like toys that make the kids think. And not just like toys that like are bells and whistles, you press a button and does things. So we need to encourage that type of like those type of play, so they're creative and it's fun, attractive, but it doesn't involve like brands and characters. Okay, so let's, yeah.
You mentioned like, really we should always provide their attention or divert their attention towards the Prophet as a role model. Like, is it also okay to set a role model within the family or within the friend circle? Because they also need something tangible, like, okay, where we can see and feel and discuss. Mm-hmm.
So the question is that, talk about role models, like can we, like we said role models, the Ahlul Bayt are our best role models, right? But can we also have role models who are within the family or within the
friend circle?
Within the friend circle, that type of thing. That can be done as well too. And in some cities they have this idea of like scouts, you know, where they have like a scouts program where you have a scout leader, and the scout leader is kind of the mentor figure for like, you know, his scouts, right? And that's something which is interesting. It's an interesting model to explore. But let's say that's not there, or you just want to choose somebody. There should be somebody who really is worthy of being emulated. Somebody who like has the right morals, the right values, the right goals as well too, right? Sometimes we choose somebody because, okay, that person, you know, academically, they were really, really good, right? Okay, fine, so they're a role model when it comes to academics, right? But are they really a role model, right? Because that same person might be trampling on other things. They're not balancing their approach to life. So we'd be careful when we set up somebody as a role model for something. But yeah, I mean, finding those people, and I mean, the whole idea of living in a community, right? Part of it is exactly that point.
I think what he was talking about is like, I don't know, maybe what I interpreted from it is not exactly a role model. Like a kid would generally idolize his father, right?
Uh-huh.
And he would look forward, like whatever the father does. Like the kids, especially from the age of 5 to 12 years, 13 years of age, they would keep on looking what a father does,
right,
on a daily basis. They would idolize that, and they would make look forward. So whatever the father is not doing the right thing, then he won't do the right thing, as you mentioned earlier also. I think role model, I don't know, maybe that may not be the right word, but within the near extended family and whatever they meet on a daily basis.
Yeah.
It's like somebody who they can idolize and start with, and maybe have a role model, a virtual role model like Dalul Bed or some books that they read and read about that role model and then kind of go from there.
Yeah, it's a good point. I've seen examples where kids limit themselves because of their cousin or something. This is what my cousin did. This is where they went to, and that's what I'm going to do as well too. Just because there's no logical reasoning behind that. Okay, so let's go on, inshallah, and then we'll pause at the end then for. So, what are some tips before a child is born? In Islam, we don't believe that child raising begins when the child is born. No, it begins before the child is born. In fact, it begins even before we get married. If you think about it, why? Because we said that the best way of raising a child is through our own example, and we're told that we're supposed to be working on ourselves even before we're married, right? And so it's very important that before the child is born, even we're starting to think about this, working on it. Just to give you an example, I was talking to this one lady, and she was complaining. She was saying that they don't have kids yet, but she was saying her husband likes to watch a lot of Western movies. Okay, so she said she went to her husband. She said that I don't think you should watch so many movies, right? He's like, no. This is what I like to do. And then she said that, well, what about when you have kids, right? This is gonna obviously have a bad impact on them. He said that no, when that happens, we have kids, then I'll stop watching the movies, right? She's like, no. She's like, I don't have any problem with having kids, but I have a problem with your watching movies. So please, if you can, get rid of this, have it before you have kids. And so she asked me, am I thinking along the right lines? And I said, yes, that's true, because it doesn't suddenly magically fall into place that once we have kids, we're gonna be all okay, everything will just kind of fall. No, the good habits that we are going to implement, for example, saying prayers on time. For example, rising for Salat al-Layl, right? I mean, one of the acts of a believer who really loves Allah, is that he or she will wake up a little bit, 10, 15 minutes before Fajr time, and just do, a little bit of, sajda and ruku on the prayer mat, right? This is something that Ahlul Bayt used to do. Right? This is what they encourage their followers to do. Now, if we imagine that's going to start happening after we have our children, when they keep us up late at night, and we're so busy trying to deal with them, right? We're fooling ourselves. It's not going to happen afterwards. I mean, sometimes it does, but usually it's a habit that we develop before, and then it carries on into when we have children, right? Because we have our schedule, we have our time for ibadah. For a mother especially, a mother who has a program of ibadah, where she does her du'as, her Qur'an, her talking to Allah, whatever it is that she's doing that is helping her go closer to Allah, that she's gotten advice on as well too. If she has that in place before she has her children, there's a good chance it will continue afterwards. But if she doesn't, then what happens is when she has children, usually she'll give 100% to her children. She'll oftentimes forget about her own self-development. And she won't have any time to work on the relationship between her and Allah. Just to do her wajib prayers becomes a struggle, because she's so busy with her child. Not because she wants to disobey Allah, but because she thinks that the best way of helping her children is to just spend all of her time with them. While the Islamic teachings tell us that no, that if a mother isn't working on herself, she doesn't have a program of worship for herself, she's not saying her prayers on time, she doesn't have that, then she doesn't feel Allah in her life, then she's only going to be so effective when it comes to being able to instill the love of God into her children. She can only go so far with that. It's going to be limited. So, it starts from that. We have to have reflected upon the goal of life. We have to commit to pursuing this goal. We have to choose a worthy spouse. And if we made a mistake in that respect, then that's okay. We can, in the sense that it's not like the end of the world now, but now we need to work at addressing that. If our spouse is at a lower level, and not the level we want them to be in order to raise the kids we want to have, then we need to start encouraging them to move up higher. And there's ways of doing that as well too. Doing du'a and tawassul for a child. Du'a is very important. Right? As a believer, we have a weapon that other people don't have, which is the weapon of du'a. And there's some du'as which are mentioned in the Qur'an that the prophets used to do when praying for their children, we should do as well too. For example, رَبِّي هَبْلِي مِنَ الصَّالِحِينَ. Oh my Lord, grant me from the righteous. Very beautiful. Rabbi habli min as-salihin. I don't just want a child. I want a child who's going to be salih, who's going to be righteous. right? A very short dua that can be recited even in your qunut sometimes. Another one is رَبَّنَا هَبْلَنَا مِنْ أَزْوَاجِنَا وَذُرِّيَاتِنَا قُرَّةَ أَعْيُنٍ وَاجْعَلْنَا لِلْمُتَّقِينَ إِمَامًا. Right, this is from the end of Surah Furqan, right, where we say, oh Allah, grant us from our spouses and our children قُرَّةَ أَعْيُنٍ, and those who will be pleasing to our eyes. Another dua is رَبِّ اجْعَلْنِي مُقِيمَ الصَّلَاةِ وَمِنْ ذُرِّيَّتِي رَبَّنَا وَتَقَبَّلْ دُعَاءِ. Like, oh Allah, make me one who does salat, وَمِنْ ذُرِّيَّتِي as well, to make my progeny, my descendants, those who do salat as well too. And another one, اللهم زُقْنِي وَزُقْ عَيَالِي مِنْ فَضْلِكَ فَإِنَّكَ ذُو فَضْلٍ عَظِيمٍ. If you guys want the duas afterwards, I can email them to you as well. Oh Allah, grant me and my dependents your rizq. Give me your risk for your provisions. This is a very beautiful dua for us. From your fadl, from your bounty. فَإِنَّكَ ذُو فَضْلٍ عَظِيمٍ. Because you indeed are the one who possesses fadl or bounty, which is adim, which is very great. So we're showing Allah that we're paying for His risk for us and our dependents as well too. These are four duas that are short but powerful in this respect. Okay, next slide, please. There's etiquette to be observed at the time of conception, when to do that, what time of the day, what days to do as well, to detailed instructions that the Prophet gave to Imam Ali alayhi salam. We should pay attention to that. I mean, it's something which is very important, right? So if you're going to plan to, somebody's planning on having a child, they should be aware of this and try to time accordingly. There's etiquette to be observed during pregnancy as well too. When a couple knows that God is expecting, they should approach a qualified alim and say, okay, what is the Islamic teachings that they should do? And they can summarize it for them. Okay, these are the steps that you need to take. And there's recommended etiquette when it comes to food and also certain things that need to be observed as well with regards to Quran and some other things as well too. And then choosing a correct name as well too. This is important. Next slide, please. Okay, that's before. Now, what about the first stage? So, in this presentation now, we're going to break it down into three stages, 0 to 7, 7 to 14, and then 14 to 21. The reason for that is because when a child grows, naturally speaking, they're going to change their personality significantly at these ages, at the age of 7 and at the age of 14. Now, who told us this? Our Prophet told us this. Right, and you've heard that hadith about the 777 hadith. We're going to talk about more about that, inshallah. He told us that not just in one hadith, multiple hadith. But it's something that even non-Muslims have discovered afterwards as well too. I was reading the book, it's called Children Are From Heaven. It's by John Gray. He's the one who wrote that book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. In that book too, he mentioned this thing that at 7 years old, like a child goes through a significant, you know, sort of transitory stage where they take on a different personality. And as a parent, I can say that I've seen that happen as well too. Something special happens at the age of 7. Even if you look at educational systems like in Sweden and in some other places in the world, they start education at the age of 7 because they know that that's the right age. Here, typically it starts a little bit too early because in the rush for wanting the kids to get out of the home and allow, like for example, the mothers to go into the workplace, they start earlier. But ideally, the ideal age for starting education is actually 7 years old. And that's what they do in those countries. And they happen to have the most successful educational systems as well, too. It's very interesting. They start the latest, but they have the most success when it comes to what happens at the end of the day. So, in the first 7 years, the basic needs of a child is freedom and play. Okay, these two important things. So, as a parent, I need to make sure that these are things that they're values, these are like sort of the way I'm operating with my child. I'm giving them freedom, and I'm giving them room to play, and I'm playing with them, I'm teaching them how to play as well too. These are very necessary for the proper raising of a child. Now, freedom, we say that in general, their wants should be fulfilled. If they want something, they should get it. But I'm emphasizing here in general. It's not like without any restrictions at all. And we're going to talk about the exceptions very soon right now. I just wanted to give you the overview. Play. Generally, like a child should be allowed and encouraged to play and do as he or she pleases in that respect. So what that means is that as a parent, I need to create play-friendly environments. I shouldn't have an environment where my child always is like kind of tiptoeing on eggshells, that type of thing, right? They should feel free to like do whatever they want. Like a father was telling me that, like, you know, like my kid always goes to the cabinet and pulls out the glass plates and starts playing with them. So I told him, why do you have glass plates in the cabinet? You know, I mean, what's the, like, let your child play, right? Either replace them with like something that's like a little bit less unbreakable, or be okay with them breaking or something, but not just because you always have to tell them that don't play with these. That's the way a child wants to be and needs to be as well too. We need to also invest time and show them how to play. I mean, maybe you have experience in respect, but I noticed that in my children, like some of them, like one of them, for example, is very good at playing on her own from the beginning. Another one, he needs to be told and taught how to play. But once I teach him, then later on, he can play that same thing again with what I taught him. So, for example, I remember teaching him how to do some make-believe thing at one point. Now, a month later, he started playing with the same thing again, but at that time, he was on his own. So if we invest time, you might not see the results immediately, but you will see them later on. Next slide, please. Now, going back to the freedom thing, right? In Hadith, we're told that in this 7 years, we should let the child be the master. What does that mean? That means that we should avoid direct orders, direct commands, and direct instruction. Don't do this, do this, stop doing that, don't do that, no, 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 that type of thing. Right? It shouldn't be that we're constantly barking orders or telling them not to do things when it comes to our children at this age. That's not the best way. That's not the ideal way. That way is going to be harmful for our children. Why? Because it goes against that principle of giving them freedom at this age. The basic reason is why don't we take this approach? It's because it doesn't work. Okay, like those of you who have children, you know that at this age, a child isn't in tune with this idea of being able to take instructions. It's just the child is a child, right? Like you tell them one thing, they have their own mind. Right? They want to be independent in that respect. That's they need to be independent. So my directly commanding them and prohibiting them is not very effective at the end of the day. Usually, what happens is parents, when they see that it's not effective, what do? They try to make their kids listen by threatening them, by attaching fear to it. That makes it even worse. Okay, because it's going to have negative repercussions later on. We'll talk about that, inshallah. So what we need to do is we need to let them be. And if we want to get them to do something, or we want them to stop doing something, we take an indirect approach. Okay, well, why don't we do this right here? Is that something that's helpful? Is it something that you? I'll give you an example of things that you can talk, say to them, right? Is this helpful for you? This right now? Why don't we try this thing over there, or something like this? That like, wouldn't it be better if we were to do this right here? Or I think it's time for us to go, you know, do this other thing. That type of indirect sort of coaxing, encouraging, diversion techniques, that's much more effective. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't any room for direct commands and orders, but it should be very limited. And we'll talk about the exceptions. Another thing is that we should let the child be. Sometimes parents, like, they're very eager for their children to be like whiz kids, right? Like, even when they're born, they start, like, I don't know, playing, like, you know, tapes and educational tapes and trying to teach them things, you know, like, trying to teach them how to read by the age of two or something like that, you know, and have them, I don't know, like, get into, like, they want to, like, if they could, have them finish high school by the age of five or something, right? Like, what's the rush, right? Okay, let's say that your child learns how to read at the age of three, okay? So is that better for you or is that worse? What do you think? Do you think it's better for you or worse for you, right? Parents will be like, oh my God, at age of three, my kids are reading. Oh, they're doing whiz kids. No, right? Because as soon as they start to read, then they want to start reading books, right? And when they read books, I'm not saying that reading books isn't good. Reading books can be useful, right? But that shuts off the capacity to learn through other means, which are very useful and very necessary as well, too. Like, for example, a child who doesn't know how to read, they'll be more keen on listening to conversations that are taking place at home. And children can learn a lot by listening to what's happening at home. Or a child will be more keen on going out and playing and stuff when they can't read their books, right? As soon as they can start reading, we have to start worrying about things like what books are good for them to read, what should not let them read. And there's a lot of like junk out there, even in children's books as well, too. So, like, it opens up a whole can of worms, right? The other thing is that you might spend like hours and hours and hours, your time and effort to try to teach your kids how to read at age 3, whereas if you just wait until they're age 5, you could teach them the same thing in like a tenth of the time. Okay? Now what are you better off, right? Even like teaching how to read Quran. Teaching our children how to read Quran is necessary. It's the responsibility of a father to arrange for that to happen. But you'll see that there's a natural age when a child will be ready to learn those letters. Like in my personal experience, when I was teaching my son at the age of, I don't know, at a certain age, I found it was very difficult. I waited 1 year. The next year when I did it, within a span of a month, it was amazing how much he was able to learn because he was ready for that. Right? You'll find that as you're working with a child, naturally speaking, there'll be a certain age when Allah has given them that ability to learn. Go along with that as opposed to trying to force something at an age which is not appropriate. Because what is the hurry after all? Is it that we want to impress other people, or our child like read the Quran, now they've done the Bismillah ceremony, I don't know what. Like, sometimes you feel things that maybe it has to do with impressing others rather than doing what's best for our kids. Imam Baqir al-Islam, the worst of parents is the one whose desire for his child's good being causes him to go to the extremes. Okay, and you find that sometimes in parents, especially in this society, like they call them the hover parents. They always hover around their child like a helicopter, you know, trying to make sure that they do the right thing and teach them the right stuff. But I'm supposed to like let them be. Okay, next slide, please. What are the red lines? When do we step in and are we allowed to like, should we directly order or prohibit? These are two examples, two sort of buckets, or two situations. One of them is when something is dangerous for the child. They're about to like, you know, hurt themselves or hurt somebody else. At that point, it's perfectly okay to step in and tell them not to do that, even sharply if need be, in order to get their attention. Another thing is when it's something which is inappropriate considering their age. So for example, they're doing something like that's really not right for that age to be doing. Like, for example, let's say at home, it's okay for them to play with the dishes and like, you know, throw them around or something like that. But at somebody else's house, it wouldn't be appropriate. Or they're about to harm another child or something like that. Or they're showing their, I don't know, you know, kids, they pull up their shirt or something like that, right? So they're doing it in a place where it's not appropriate for them to do it or something like that. That type of thing, where it's something which is inappropriate or unbecoming, not for us, but for them at that age. That would be another situation, especially when it comes to interacting with others. Otherwise, we should do an indirect approach. Now, if there is a need to scold the child for something, it should be done with love and compassion, and not strictness. Being strict, this is not the age for being strict. It's not going to have an impact in the long run if we're harsh. Rather, we should be loving and compassionate and lenient in this age of observance. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, the results now. What happens is that if we're able to do this at this age, then the potential is being unlocked in that child. Because letting them taste freedom, letting them taste play, it's opening up their minds, it's opening up their hearts as well too. We're unlocking their potential, and they're developing trust in us as parents. They're seeing our love for them. They know that they can always turn to their parents. They always look to us, and we've always shown them love. And we're readying them for the next stage, which is going to be that of obedience. All right, and they're developing a mature and tolerant personality. Like, look at this. So, Imam Qadim, how good it is for a child to be full of movement and life. Don't restrict them. Let them be when they're young, so that they can be calm and forbearing in their later years. It's necessary for them to go to this stage. What happens if we restrict them and we cut off their freedom at the age of 0 to 7? That's when we have rebellious teenagers, right? Because after all, it's part of their character. They need that freedom. And if they're always contained at that age, then they're going to let it go. Well, where would you rather have your child be rebellious? And where would you rather have them be boisterous? When they're 0 to 7 or when they become teenagers, right? I would definitely choose 0 to 7. Right? I think you would too. Right, next slide, please. This one will skip. Okay, next slide. Okay, one of the other things, in terms of tips, right? What do scholars mention in terms of effective sort of things? One of them is storytelling. Storytelling can be very effective. It can be stories from the Quran, it can be other stories as well too, even if they're not like Islamic stories, but stories of good deeds. This can be very effective as a way of teaching our children morals. We can tell them the story, and then once in a while you make kind of references to some of the lessons that you learned from the story. Not that you have to focus a long time on it, but just once in a while you make, they'll get the point when you're just saying that. Stories of ulama, pious individuals, prophets, imams, companions. I found in my own experience that stories of Quran have really worked well with my kids. I don't know what it is about them. I found them that they really enjoy those. And I don't know if you have similar experiences. Next slide, please. About wajibat, at this age, we want to encourage natural gravitation towards wajibat, not impose in this age. We're not forcing them to do things. Encourage. We shouldn't force them to pray. We should encourage them to pray at this age. We have to learn about the techniques for introducing salat to our children. I mentioned that already. Only when they get to be about 6 years old, then once in a while we insist on wajibat. But otherwise, we're encouraging them and creating that environment. When it comes to mustahabat, we shouldn't be particular about them. But we should mention them from time to time. This is where I find a lot of parents make mistakes. So for example, they'll insist on their child like doing some things that like aren't even necessary, right? So what is an example of that? Like, let's say like, I mean, different cultures have different ways of dealing with this. So, like for example, let's say that when it comes to fasting, okay, like some cultures they take pride when their child can fast at the age of 3 years old or 4 years old. Okay, now where do we have in hadith that the Ahlul Bayt encourage children to fast at 4 years old? They don't. Okay, there's a certain age. There's a 7 years old is when we ask. I think it's 7 years old when we ask our children to start fasting. And even that partial fast, that part of the day, and they tell us that 8 years old is when you should ask your children to start fasting. I believe that's the day, at the age 7 and 8. But sometimes we take pride. We say that okay, at 5 years old, my child is able to fast a whole day, and you'll find that sometimes the adults will go and ask the children, like, did you fast or not? And they'll make them feel bad for not fasting, even though it's not even something that's mustahab. Or maybe it's mustahab, but let's say when it's a long fast like it is in the summertime, then it wouldn't be good for the child. It's going to have a negative effect when they grow older as well too. Similar with other mustahab things, we have to take it easy on these things. Like, you know, we shouldn't, like, let's say, like, we want to teach the children how to do namaz, salat, right? Should we insist that they do all the du'as afterwards? No, even wudu. Like, wudu is something which is wajib for salat, right? But if you look in the instructions of the Ahlul Bayt, they say that at the age of three, the first thing you do at the age of three, you make your child do a sajda. Just a sajda. Right? The wudu comes, like, I don't know, at the age of like 6 or 7, that's what they say. So the order is very important as well too. Like, what's the what are we trying to convey? Like, the most important thing is like the idea that we have a God that we worship and we ask for help and we thank Him for what He's given us. That happens in the sajda. The wudu comes later on. So the order is also important as well. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, that was stage one. Now, as I said, that if somebody does a good job in stage one, then comes stage two. Now, naturally speaking, we're going to see that our children will change their personality. Now they're going to be looking for some guidance and some instruction from their parents. Okay? Sometimes parents make the mistake. They think that, okay, as soon as my child turns 7, now I need to change my attitude towards them completely. Before I was this loving, sort of caring children that used to, you know, listen to my child. Now I'm going to turn to like a strict authoritarian. I'm going to start commanding my child. That's not what the hadith is teaching us. No. It's talking about a natural tendency in the child. At the age of 7, around 7, maybe it might be 8 years old, maybe even 9 years old, they're going to start switching into this mode where they're going to look for instruction and guidance. And we have to be ready to provide it for them. So that's why we're told in hadith that at this point, the child is your slave. Not that we're forcing that upon them, but they themselves are looking to us for direction and guidance. Next slide, please. So this is the most important stage in terms of raising development. Even if parents made a mistake in the first 7 years, at this stage, if they do the right things, they can overcome that. This is really where the foundation is set. If at this stage parents don't do a good job, it's very, very hard to then change the way a child's going to be from 14 onwards. around 15 and after, then like they've pretty much already set on their way. It's not that it can't happen, but it's very difficult for it to happen. But this is the key age. This is the age to focus on learning etiquette, developing moral traits. Some of the tips that we have from a hadith from our teachers, one of them is that at this age, a child will obviously be situations where they have, you know, they act badly, they don't do the right thing. How do we respond to that? We have to respond in a very logical way, not in an emotional way. Sometimes parents at this age, they start getting the habit of like debating with their children, discussing things and like debating and fighting over things, like back and forth, back and forth. Teachers tell us that no, it shouldn't be that way. Like when dialogue gets tense, like, just give them some time to like think. Say, okay, I want you to think about what I said, and when you're ready to talk about it, come back and discuss with me. Not that we should always be trying to justify what we do or always be willing and open to discuss our decisions with our children. Next slide, please. At this age, it's important. Playtime is important at this age as well too. But it's not the dominant thing. It's not that it's something which has such a focus as it did in the first 7 years. So at this time, everything should be scheduled, including the playtime as well. And this is very important, that we shouldn't just have time when the children are just let to be, to do whatever they want. No, even their free time should be scheduled as well too. There shouldn't be time for just pure idleness, where they're like, okay, I'm bored, let me just go and surf the internet, or just go on whatever it is, like websites that they go to, or talk to their friends, or chat with their friends. We have to fill that free time with things like exercise, sports, community activities, reading, memorization of the Quran. If we want to view media, we should do it as a family. It shouldn't be the case that we're not aware of what our children are watching. We should watch things that are appropriate and discuss them as well too. And we have to come up to alternatives to movies and TV, things like nature and family crafts, sports as well too. If you have a backyard, there's nothing wrong with playing sports in that backyard as a family as well. This is very important that we come up with good alternatives to this, where we show our kids that being Muslim and being a good Muslim doesn't mean that we don't have fun. And we can have fun, but it's halal sort of fun. Not that we always have to go and have fun the same way that everyone else in the society has fun, by going to the movie theaters, for example, and doing other things like that. The last stage is the stage, just only a couple of slides left for the presentation. This is the age of 14 to 21. Just a couple of tips on this. We have to understand that at this age, the youth are seeking independence and they want respect from others. That's what we're told in the hadith, that you take your child as a consul, a wazir, somebody that you consult with. Not that every decision you make, now it's you, the husband, the wife, and the child. No, it's not like that. But once in a while, we reach out and seek the opinion of our child when it comes to making decisions. And that's something, at this age, it will really make them feel very, very happy and very confident. Because they're looking to like feel that confidence and feel that they are responsible, and they're moving into adulthood as well too. So they want to feel that they're taken seriously by the parents as well too. So one of the things that has to happen in this age is the parents have to give the youth some serious responsibilities, and not be nitpicky about their faults and the mistakes. They should know that it's a serious responsibility. They're not going to be perfect at it from the beginning. They should allow them to make mistakes and grow in that. But they have to make them responsible. Like one of the things that prevents early marriages from happening in our communities and from them to be successful is that our children aren't given enough responsibility at the right ages. They grow up, and even at the age of 21, they're just like older children, right? And they've been pampered their whole lives. At this age, 14, 21, they have to stop being pampered so much, they have to start getting some serious responsibilities. Next slide, please. It's also very important that at this age, like the process of learning about ideology and about our beliefs and ahkam, our practical responsibility, this becomes very serious and very intense as well too. Look at this hadith, like Imam Sadiq says, is it? I don't like to see a youth among you except that he either be learning or teaching. If he does not do so, he has failed in his responsibility. And if he has failed, he has wasted himself. And if he wastes himself, he has sinned. And if he sins, he will live in fire by the one who dispatched Muhammad. It's scary, right? This is Imam's expectations of youth. And oftentimes, like we look at this and we're like, we're so far away from this. Like our children who become experts on chemistry, on biology, on computer science, and on all these disciplines. But when it comes to like these children who can get into the best universities, you ask them about the basics of ahkam, they're not aware of some of these like types of rulings and stuff. Right? So we have to invest in this for our children. Next slide, please. There's some important traits and characteristics to nurture. One of them is desire to fight against oppression. This is the age to talk about, to install these things. Feeling responsible for the society around me. This has to begin even from an earlier age, but especially at this age needs to be fostered. And then the yearning for rebuilding the world with a system of global justice. Like, this is part of our responsibility as being Shias, that we want our children to like feel the pain and feel that they have a responsibility towards this greater goal of bringing about the coming of the Imam of our time. Okay, next slide. Okay, so I have two more slides. These are just things that I've seen in my travels in different communities in the West over the last, X number of years. Like, I've seen some things that seem to have worked, meaning that it seems to have produced children who are outstanding. Of course, we never know, right? Because we can only see them in a snapshot of time. I only see them as a visitor. But just some ideas for you to kind of take, and just from my perspective, things that I want to share with you. Two slides, and then we'll end up, inshallah. Next slide, please. So one of them is, like, I've seen that when there's families who have family friends, even just one family, all right, but if there's more family, that's even better, where the parents agree to have this, they have the same ideology. I'm not saying that they're just Shia or they're just Muslim, no. They have the same ideology, meaning that they have the same approach towards life and the same approach towards things like consumption of media, TV watching, movie watching, gender interaction, socializing. All these things, they have the same values on. And if their children are of similar age, especially if it's like the same genders as well too, that seems to work. When even if the kids have one other person other than themselves who are like them, then it has a huge impact on the way that they grow. Another one is having a political ideology. And I'm giving you an example. Like, I went to somebody's home and I saw that they had a picture of the Rahbar at the home. A couple of them, like nice pictures. Like not, you know, like scary looking ones. I'm thinking about the ones that looked very stately and like you know, like a leader figure, right? Just that itself, I felt that, you know, growing up in that environment where there is a political ideology, there's this notion of like, well, what is Islam about? Is it just like a bunch of like, just kind of a personal religion, or is there like a greater goal behind this to establish justice on the earth, and we have a leadership associated with that? That picture itself symbolizes that whole concept, right? And when children see that, it has an impact on them. I found that the children who grow up to parents who have this ideology will understand it. It's not just a slogan, they actually believe in it as well too. It has an impact on the way the kids are. They're more serious about Islam, and they see it being relevant to the current times. Otherwise, Islam becomes something which is to do with the time of the Imams, right? Like, we think about coming of Imam Zaman, we think about Imam Zaman coming, we think about him coming, and then just curing all the oppression, just like that, like magic. Whereas, like, somebody who has a political ideology realizes that, wait a minute, I have a role to play as well, too. And it brings the whole message of the past to the present, and makes it much more relevant and current as well, too. Another one is taking pious ulama as mentor. What I mean by that is, when the parents have a relationship with ulama, they bring them home, they invite them home, they're talking to them, they ask them about their, they consult them on issues that they're facing in life, on major decisions, they take them as counselors. When the kids see that, that has an impact on the way they are raised as well too. And they will grow up having a greater love for the deen, because that's what the ulama represent. Humility, when the parents, even if they're at a very high level of taqwa, even if they're at a very high level of knowledge about Islam, if they're humble in their approach towards that, they don't always criticize like others, they don't always look down on others, they don't criticize ulama in the presence of their children unnecessarily. They always are humble with respect to their own position. They're always asking for advice, you know, and seeing how they can improve themselves. That has an impact on their children as well, too. Another one is focusing on the big picture, not getting caught up in the details, where the parents are clear on the big pictures about life and Islam, and they emphasize those, not like all the small little details when it comes to their kids. Especially like those mustahabat that, like for example, focusing on mustahab things without focusing on the wajibat, right? That would be an example of that. not giving undue importance to sakya, meaning that sometimes when I see that parents make getting into like the top university like the most important thing in life, right? Getting like being a 4.0 or I don't know what the GPA system you have here, 20 or whatever it is that you have, making that be like the top thing in life, second to none, right? Even God, then that has an impact on the children. Whereas if education is one of the things that's stressed along with other things, a balanced approach towards that has a huge impact on children. Loving relationships, when the father and mother genuinely love each other for the sake of God, when they love their children and they show that, like one of the really outstanding families I saw, like I saw that the kids, whenever they would see their parents, they would actually kiss them. You know, and I thought that was like really like beautiful, you know, like they had so much respect and love that they would kiss their parents. I'm not saying that we should force something that's not there, but the display of physical, like physical display of affection with our children is very important. Not assuming a different identity inside of the home. When inside of the home, it's the same as if we're outside. Meaning that sometimes parents inside, they act differently, they talk differently. They would never do the stuff inside publicly that they do inside, the way they talk about people, the way they act. It's not like they have like this, you know, Clark Kent, Superman identity when they leave the home. No, it's one and the same, inside and outside, that has an impact. And then special respect for the daughters. When the fathers have special love, and even the mothers as well, of course, special love for their daughters, special respect, that has a huge impact because our girls have a lot of pressure on them. With the hijab, especially in this environment, there's a lot of pressure, right? So they need extra love and extra attention, especially from the fathers. They shouldn't be thirsty for love and admiration such that they have to get it from outside of the family and outside of their father figures and their brothers. So with that, we'll end the presentation. If there's any questions that you guys have, you can take those, otherwise we'll end up with you.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.